It is Thursday, August 11th here in Washington, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin. In the next half hour, U.S. Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton unveils her economic plans in a major policy speech. We'll get analysis on how her economic policies measure up to her Republican rival, Donald Trump. We'll find out why tensions are escalating between Russia and Ukraine. We also have a look at some surprising economic benefits to Britain of its decision to leave the EU. And we review a new video game that lets players explore new galaxies and discover new life forms. It's all ahead on International Edition. Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton says her economic proposals would help a wide range of U.S. workers. She was speaking Thursday in a policy address to supporters at a defense manufacturing plant in the Midwestern state of Michigan.
And as Secretary of State, I fought hard for American businesses to get a fair shot around the world and to stop underhanded trading practices like currency manipulation and the theft of intellectual property. So as president, I will stand up to China and anyone else who tries to take advantage of American workers and companies.
Well, earlier I spoke to Shia Kabas, Director of Fiscal Policy at the Washington-based Bipartisan Policy Center. I asked him what was new about Hillary Clinton's speech.
Well, you know, I think she hit a lot of themes that she's been hitting throughout this campaign, which is contrasting herself with her opponent, of course, and trying to frame her policies around a middle-class agenda that is going to produce economic growth and also ensuring that, as she puts it, that the highest income taxpayers pay their fair share. And so a lot of her proposals were on the tax side of things, and she proposes to change elements of the tax code that would increase taxes on the top 1% by and large, maybe a little bit larger group than that, but it's really focused at the very top of the income spectrum.
And how does Clinton's approach to taxing the highest income earners compare with what Trump was talking about earlier this week?
So Donald Trump, in contrast, has proposed to substantially reduce the top marginal tax rate. Right now, it's just under 40%. He proposes to lower that down to, I think the latest is 33%. And so he is actually proposing to reduce taxes on the highest income taxpayers. Now, a big difference between the two plans is that Donald Trump's plan would be a significant overall tax cut. Originally, it was scored at around $10 trillion over 10 years. He's since made some modifications, and so I think it would be in the ballpark of a few trillion dollars, whereas Secretary Clinton proposes to raise additional revenues of about $1 trillion over 10 years. So they go a little bit in the opposite direction in terms of the impact on government revenue and therefore government debt.
And how do you see the impact of both plans on the overall economy? What are they trying to go for?
So there's an argument to be made that reducing taxes and people's marginal tax rates could spur economic growth because it'll increase investment, increase labor. But I think there's also an argument to be made on the other side that we already have large deficits and a large pile of debt that we have as a country that's equal to about 70-some-odd percent of our GDP, of our total economy. And that's quite significant and rising more in the future. And so I think taking into account the impact that these plans would have on that debt in the future and putting in a tax reform that both encourages economic growth but also helps us to improve our fiscal picture are important steps to consider.
And do you think that both candidates have elements of that in their plans?
I think they certainly both have elements of that. I think Donald Trump's plan focuses more on what he would consider the growth aspect, that lowering tax rates will encourage more economic growth and grow the pie, per se, whereas Secretary Clinton, I think, focuses a little bit more on the bringing in additional revenue to the federal government by having higher income taxpayers contribute more. She would probably argue that elements of her plan are also meant to spur economic growth, but I think there is a contrast between the two in terms of how they view the tax code and what its goals and specific aspects should be.
Well, just one more area I'd like to look at, and that is trade. Hillary Clinton did reemphasize her opposition to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. How different is her approach to that than Trump, who also is against the TPP?
You know, it's interesting, and it's a good question, because I've been listening a lot to their language over the past several months on this issue. And while they talk about it a little bit differently, they do seem to have both ended up in a similar position. And I think that's partly because of the political reality, is just that people have come out with a very visceral reaction to these trade deals and the way they've been portrayed. And the case with trade in general is that while it's generally good for overall economic growth for any country, our country, trade deals can often have adverse impacts on specific pockets or specific populations, specific occupations. And so the drawbacks tend to be concentrated among small populations, whereas the benefits tend to be dispersed over the entire population. And so I think they both ended up in a position where they are generally against the trade deals that we have in place now or are currently negotiating. But certainly Secretary Clinton and I think also Donald Trump have said that they are both pro-trade in general. It's just that they want the right trade deals for the United States. And so without getting into a lot of granularity, they've placed themselves in relatively similar positions on the spectrum.
Well, thanks very much to Shai Acabas of the Bipartisan Policy Center here in Washington for speaking to International Edition.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Well, it's time now for our social media segment. And as always, our G. Abby Lee joins me in the studio with what is trending online. Hi, G.
Hi, Michael. The online community is talking about what GOP presidential candidate Donald Trump said during his rally in Florida Wednesday. He not only insinuated but flat out argued President Barack Obama is the founder of terrorist group ISIS. Now, that controversial quote reads like this: "In many respects, they honor President Obama. He's the founder of ISIS. He founded ISIS. And I would say the co-founder would be crooked Hillary Clinton." He doubled down on that comment during multiple interviews on Thursday, most notably with conservative radio host Hugh Hewitt.
Now, Hugh Hewitt was asking Trump if what he really meant to say was that, you know, Obama's policies on the Middle East, you know, contributed to the rise of ISIS. How did Trump react to that?
So, like you said, Hewitt wanted to see if he meant more indirectly, but Trump actually cut him off and said, "No, I meant he's a founder of ISIS. I do. He was the most valuable player. I give him the most valuable player award." And he added, "I give her too, by the way, Hillary Clinton."
So what has the reaction been like online?
As you can imagine, people's reactions to news usually depends on the media account they're following, which sadly shows a polarization in U.S. media. But there is one person who has vested interest in this remark, and that's his Democratic rival, Hillary Clinton. She tweeted, "No, Barack Obama is not the founder of ISIS," and more than 11,000 people liked that comment. A longer version of that tweet is available on her Facebook page. She wrote, "It can be difficult to muster outrage as frequently as Donald Trump should cause it, but his smear against President Obama requires it. No, Barack Obama is not the founder of ISIS. Anyone willing to sink so low, so often, should never be allowed to serve as our commander-in-chief." Now, as for Trump, he didn't tweet about his comment or reaction to Clinton's statement. And let's go back to the public's reaction. Here is a top comment under Clinton's post: "I am pretty sure President Obama played a role in the Abraham Lincoln and the JFK assassination as well. And dinosaurs would still be alive if Obama didn't let the meteor hit the earth." Nearly 6,000 people liked it. And that was, of course, a sarcastic remark.
Right.
And on the right-wing TV station Fox News' Facebook, the top comment to the related article reads like this: "If it walks like a criminal and barks like a criminal, then you know it's Hillary." Some 700 people liked that comment. Michael, back to you.
Thank you very much, G. Well, you can tweet us with your comments and questions at VOA_IE. If you want to find me on Twitter, I'm at Michael_Lippin, and G is at G. Abby Lee. Well, here are some of the top stories now on VOAnews.com. Major setback reported in Nigeria, two new cases of polio. Syrian doctors appeal for end to bombings and sieges in Aleppo. Turkey bombs Kurdish rebels in Iraq after deadly attacks. Q key U.S. military command accused of manipulating Islamic State reports. And UN to discuss Crimea tensions. Expanded coverage of these stories and more is on voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Russian President Vladimir Putin has accused Ukraine of using terror tactics in Crimea, a part of Ukraine that Russia annexed 2 years ago following a military incursion. Putin made the accusation Wednesday as the Russian Federal Security Service said that it foiled an attack earlier this month by Ukrainian military intelligence, an attack that it said killed two Russian security personnel. Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko has rejected the Russian accusations, calling them fantasies that are just a pretext for more Russian military threats against Ukraine. Well, U.S. State Department spokeswoman Elizabeth Trudeau said Wednesday the real issue remains Moscow's land grab in Crimea.
We don't want to be distracted from the real issue here, which is not only Russia's occupation and attempted annexation of Crimea, but their continued aggression in eastern Ukraine. Our view on Crimea is well known. Crimea is and will always be part of Ukraine. We condemn and call for an immediate end to the Russian occupation of Crimea, and our Crimea-related sanctions will remain in place until Russia returns the peninsula to Ukraine. But we always think there's a point of conversation. We always think that dialogue is a process that should be explored. As you know, we've supported the Minsk process as we move forward. Dialogue is really where we'd like to see this go.
Well, John Besmers is a researcher on Eastern European affairs at the Australian National University. Besmers told VOA's Victor Beattie that he sees a pattern of Russian behavior that could be a prelude to an escalation of Moscow's dispute with Kiev.
Sometimes they do that, I think, in order to pressure everybody, and it may be aimed at trying to get some movement favorable to them in the Minsk process, so-called. But it does look very much like an escalation. They've been moving heavy weaponry into the area, and they may well judge the present moment to be propitious in that the United States, if I may say so, is heavily preoccupied with a most unusual and contentious presidential election process. And we also have the EU in more than its usual state of confusion. And so the West is not well configured. And I think certainly, regardless of what anyone might think about what I've just said, that, I think, is the view from Moscow.
What is their ultimate objective, sir, in your view?
Well, in my view, they're not content with their present arrangements in Ukraine. They, in particular, they want to convert what they hold in eastern Ukraine into a veto over Ukraine's foreign policy. And they don't have enough to achieve that just yet. And the Minsk process gives them some of it, but it doesn't give them enough. So I think it's always likely to be the case that at a moment they judge to be favorable, they may want to go further. They would want to expand their holdings in eastern Ukraine. They would very much like to have a government in Kiev, which, if it doesn't actually do their bidding, is very responsive, at least, to their requirements. And, of course, things are moving slowly, but moving in their favor. The situation, economic situation in Ukraine is dismal. The government has made some quite brave decisions, in particular to restore fiscal balance, but it is not making the kinds of decisions that Western critics and the IMF would like to see. And so they're in a very precarious position. And they're also precarious politically. The Poroshenko administration is struggling. It's become increasingly unpopular because it's had to take unpopular decisions. The population don't see much movement on the war. So for various reasons, they're not doing terribly well at the moment. And I think there is a sense in Moscow, certainly, and I think also a sense actually in Western Europe, that sanctions, European EU sanctions, are going to be lifted the next time they, or eased the next time they come up for review. So in general, I think Putin feels that things are going his way. It's a favorable moment from the geopolitical point of view and from various other points of view, and it may be a good time to do some business.
That was John Besmers speaking to VOA's Victor Beattie. Well, it's been a month and a half since Britain's shocking decision to leave the European Union, a referendum result that has brought a number of surprises. Contrary to predictions, nations, largely those of the British Commonwealth in Africa and the Pacific, have lined up to sign trade agreements with Britain. At the same time, London is seeing a tourist boom due to the pound's drop against the dollar after Brexit. VOA Europe correspondent Louise Ramirez reports.
A weak pound has meant for many a chance to see London for the first time. One of Brexit's unforeseen benefits, an 18% rise in foreign visitors. Hotels, airlines, and visitor attractions in London report a dramatic rise in sales and guests, many from Asia, undeterred by fears of terrorism in Europe.
The terrorism, yeah, we understand. But because the pound is quite low now, so it's actually a good time for us to travel to London.
Because now the pound is in a very low rate, it's cheaper for us to buy things or to traveling everywhere, yeah.
It's
a good time to come.
The markets have continued to see volatility after Brexit, which is not a surprise. What is a surprise to some are reports that 27 countries are expressing interest in securing trade deals with Britain. Many of those are Commonwealth nations like Ghana, a former British colony. Economists see opportunity for new trade deals that some believe could change the colonial-era paradigm that has for decades created strange situations where African farmers could sell their unprocessed products to Europe only to re-import them as manufactured goods. Britain has not negotiated a trade deal on its own since 1973. The British government is rushing to take advantage of the renewed interest from other countries, assembling teams of trade negotiators in the hope Brexit's predicted downturn may actually end up being a boom. Luis Ramirez, VOA News, London.
This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
It's thought that the first telescopes emerged sometime in the 17th century. But is it possible that ancient stargazers could have studied the heavens with their own observation tools long before the modern telescope? Scientists are proposing to learn whether or not long, narrow passageways or prehistoric tombs were used as a way to enhance views of the night sky some 6,000 years ago. The scientists want to find out if the human eye might be able to see stars of any given brightness or color without the help of any telescopic device in locations such as the Seven Stone Antas in central Portugal. Those proposing this investigation say that ancient astronomers were able to better observe certain stars from deep within one of these passageways. Spotting a particular star may have provided a way to mark the seasons. I am VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. A new computer game lets players explore new galaxies, discover new life forms, fight battles, and mine for treasure. The game, called No Man's Sky, has been launched for PS4 and PC. As International Edition's David Byrd reports, the game was developed in a shed in Guildford, England, and has polarized players worldwide.
I've seen things. Galaxies waiting to be found.
Seeing things seems to be one of the points of the long-awaited No Man's Sky game from Hello Games in Britain. You are one of several roles, a trader, an adventurer, a warrior, and you discover new worlds and new life forms. You gain riches or fight battles in your ship. Some planets have never been discovered. Others have been because there is evidence of alien life forms on them. Some of the aliens are friendly, or at least they don't want to kill you and eat you. There are planets where the temperature is several hundred degrees Celsius. Others are made of ice. Game creator Sean Murray says that the unpredictability of the game and players' need to adapt is part of its lure.
When you boot up the game, you're on a planet. A planet-sized planet, you know, which itself is unique to games. But you're also probably on a different planet than anyone else. When they boot it up, everyone is on their own unique planet, and from there they start their own unique journey because of that.
The game was designed and published by Murray and Hello Games, which is a creative team of 15 people in southern England. Sean Murray says the small size of his team ensures that the computer-generated environments give players a unique experience.
So it's pretty daunting for Hello Games to know that it is tiny 15 guys working in basically a shed in Guildford, making this game that everyone's talking about. We never set out to like take on the big boys or anything like that, even though that seems to be happening. What we actually set out to do was make something really different, something really unique, and offer a very different experience to what you normally see in video games.
Some reviewers have criticized No Man's Sky for being at once addictive and tedious. Players get excited about a new discovery and the acquisition of treasure to trade for upgrades. The aesthetic has been widely praised, as has the soundtrack, though some reviewers found the repetitiveness of the game frustrating. But it's the lure of discovery that pulls players back into the game. Who knows what's on the next planet? Will you discover something no one has ever seen before? Will you survive? You have to play to find out. Sean Murray says that the scale of the universes his team created allows players to have a unique experience regardless of how many players are online.
So to give you an idea of the size of our universe in No Man's Sky, it's got 2 to the power of 64 planets. Or 18 quintillion planets, which is a huge number and it's hard to wrap your head around. So the thing I worked out was if a planet was discovered every second in the game by players, then it would take 584 billion years to discover them all.
No Man's Sky is available for both PS4 game consoles and PCs. Prices in the United States start at around $60. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Well, that's a wrap-up International Edition on The Voice of America. Your director today was Tracy Cotter. The engineer was Carl Starling. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. If you want to find me on Twitter, I am at Michael_Lippin. Have a great weekend.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Fulgens Kayeshima, a former police official in the Republic of Rwanda, is wanted for taking part in the Rwandan genocide in the early 1990s. In his capacity as inspector of the judicial police in Kivumu Commune, Mr. Kayeshima was one of the main instigators of killings there aimed at committing genocide. In April 1994, he helped organize and took part in an attack by his communal police on a church where refugees fleeing the violence had sought shelter. Some 2,000 people died in the attack. For these and other crimes, the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, the ICTR, indicted Mr. Kayeshima on charges of genocide and war crimes and issued a warrant for his arrest. The United States is cooperating with other governments, the United Nations and ICTR, to make it harder for Mr. Kayeshima and others sought for the killing to continue to elude justice. Toward that end, the U.S. has renewed an offer of a reward for up to $5 million for information leading to his arrest. Fulgens Kayeshima fled Rwanda and is believed to be living in the southern African region. He is believed to be living in one of the countries in southern Africa and travels a lot within the region. If you or anyone you know has information on his activities and whereabouts, it can be provided with complete confidentiality. You may contact the nearest U.S. embassy, or you can call internationally, 243-81-715-2501, or by email at rewardsforjusticedrc@yahoo.com, or on the internet at www.rewardsforjustice.net/warcrimes. The U.S. guarantees that all reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.